Our sermon title this morning in 2 Samuel 15 and the first half of 16 is A Throne is Evacuated. A Throne is Evacuated. We'll be considering how David, amid the conspiracy of his son Absalom, is forced to flee from Jerusalem, entirely uncertain when he will ever be back. This comes at a time in David's life when, as I mentioned earlier in the service, he is still dealing with the great consequences of his serious sin with Bathsheba. David, as some of the last great battles of his reign were being fought, as Israel was near to achieving final victory over their enemies and establishing all the territory that God had promised to them, David was staying home from battle, for better or for worse. But what was definitely bad was that up on his roof one evening, he got to looking around and saw the wife of another man, a man who happened to be one of his greatest soldiers fighting in that battle that I just referred to. And David, in a fit of lust, called for her to be brought to him, took her, and when what had happened led to a child being conceived and the sin couldn't be covered, in an effort to cover it, he has had the man killed so that he could then take this woman as his wife. And again continue to try to cover the sin, but God had seen, sent the prophet Nathan to expose David. And thankfully, because God was at work in David's heart, David repented. He confessed his sin. He turned from it, and yet there was a promise that he would be judged. That promise was found in 2 Samuel 12, verses 9 through 11, as the prophet Nathan asks, "Why have you despised the word of the Lord to do what is evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and have taken his wife to be your wife and have killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house. But because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife, thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you out of your own house." These are God's consequences on David for that sin. And yet, David still also lives, as we considered last week, under that great promise that God had made to him years earlier, as recorded in 2 Samuel 7. Where God had said, "I will give you rest from all your enemies," that would be international enemies. "Moreover, the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house," meaning a dynasty. "And when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom, and he shall build a house for my name," meaning a temple, "and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. And I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of iron, with the stripes of the sons of men. But my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took it from Saul," David's predecessor, "whom I put away from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever." Let me read verse 16 of 2 Samuel 7 one more time. God's promise to David, "Your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever." And so even while David lives under the just consequences of his sin, which are, we'll consider that later, they're God's loving hand in his life to confront his sin, David still has this promise of steadfast love from God, that his family line would rule forever. And ultimately, We've been talking about how that points forward to Jesus, the one who would come from David's family. And though he was killed, dying in our place, would rise from the grave, and he does live to reign forever over God's true Israel, God's people, all who would come to Christ in repentance and faith. So David lives in this strange time between those two promises. As he faces the rebellion of his son Absalom and the ugliness of Absalom's treachery against him, we're going to see how God is gloriously still with him. Our central theme then is that in the face of ugly treachery, God's beauty shines through in the life of his chosen king. In the face of ugly treachery, God's beauty shines through in the life of his chosen king. The last few chapters of this book have been sad for me. I hope sad for any of you who were delighting in how David reflected the beauty of God in so many ways throughout so much of his life, and then were so grieved when he fell so far, so fast. But in this chapter, amid tremendously painful and sorrowful experiences that David is going through, God's refining him. God's beauty is showing through in David. And so in a strange way, amid this a real tragedy in David's family life, the beauty begins to return. It's almost refreshing. So I have a question for you before we begin to dive in. I wonder, when are you at your best? Are you at your best when others around you are at their best? When you can feed off of their goodness, and it's just easier to go along with the good things that are happening around you? That's a natural human experience. Or have you experienced times in your life when you are at your best, even though things around you are at their worst? If that has been the case in seasons of your life, as a follower of God, I think it's because you're reflecting Him as we're made to. Because God's goodness is not dependent on anyone else's. God is self-existent in all His holy perfection. His goodness is not dependent on anyone else's, and in fact stands out the brightest against others' failure and sin and rebellion. And so one of the strange blessings of following Him is that He will often, sometimes unexpectedly, give us remarkable joy, remarkable strength when things are at their worst. In fact, we should be asking and expecting that this is how He will work. Because then His strength in us by His Spirit, His helping hand, His image being reflected in us can be displayed the greatest. And so, this is just the very beginning of the admonition, but when you are in circumstances where others around you are not at their best, and the circumstances are hard or even tragic, the first call is look to God. Seek His help to behold His beauty. Ask for His strength that the character you need that cannot be absorbed from others around you, perhaps, would come from Him, and seek His face. When Well, let's consider then how God is doing this in the life of David. In the face of ugly treachery, God's beauty shines through in the life of his chosen king. We'll consider this in two parts. First of all, we're going to see Absalom's conspiracy in verses 1 through 12 of chapter 15. And then we'll consider David's flight in 15, 13 through 16, 14. So first of all, Absalom's conspiracy. David has just allowed Absalom to come back to Jerusalem after Absalom had been in exile for years. Absalom had killed his own brother, Amnon, who had been the heir apparent to the throne, after Amnon had acted wickedly toward his own sister, toward Absalom's full sister, Amnon's half-sister. This household is quite a mess. And so Absalom had acted in vengeance, and he had acted unjustly. Though the crime needed to be dealt with, it was not a capital offense, but Absalom took matters into his own hands, largely because David wouldn't. And so now it's been a few years. Absalom lived in exile. Now Absalom had been called back to Jerusalem through the workings of David's right-hand man, Joab. And now Absalom has been living for 2 years in Jerusalem. And finally, after 2 years, David has allowed Absalom to come into his presence and has at least given a formality of, okay, Absalom, I acknowledge that you're back. I acknowledge that you're my son. And by all appearances, Absalom is the next in line for the throne. It appears that he's David's oldest living son at this point. And so that's where the story stands as we come into chapter 15. So Absalom is living in Jerusalem, but he remains unpunished, unforgiven, and unashamed, as one man put it. And we're going to see how unhealthy that dynamic is. This man, Absalom, whose name means father of peace or peace of my father, is going to be anything but peaceful for David. Verse 1. After this, Absalom got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way of the gate. And when any man had a dispute to come before the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you?" And when he said, "Your servant is of such and such a tribe in Israel," Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but there is no man designated by the king to hear you." Then Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were judge in the land. Then every man with a dispute or a cause might come to me, and I would give him justice." And whenever a man came to pay homage to him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. And thus Absalom did to all of Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Absalom was described in chapter 14 as an absolutely gorgeous man. No blemish in him from the sole of his feet to the crown of his head. A luxurious head of hair. Just a real treat to look on. Now he begins to add to his spectacular appearance other elements of kingly presentation. He gets a chariot for himself, which would have been rather impractical in a hilly city like Jerusalem. But it's not about being practical, it's about making a show. He gets 50 men to run before him. That seems entirely unnecessary. Everywhere he goes in the city of Jerusalem, he rides in a chariot with this entourage running before him. This is the ultimate acting out of that old proverb, dress for the job you want. He is doing everything to look like a king. Unfortunately, Absalom is far more concerned about his external appearance than he is about the condition of his heart. He shows no concern for God's stated purposes. He shows no concern for the fact that God has declared that his father is to be the king until the time of his father's death. And as he makes his political moves, real spiritual sincerity is the last thing on his mind. Absalom understands the art of presentation, of marketing himself, which, by the way, is not necessarily a bad thing. It's not bad to dress for the job you want, as long as that's the job God wants you to have. It's not bad to present yourself as well as possible. But the problem is that Absalom's good external appearance is a cover for a bad heart. As he styles himself as more impressive and more desirable than his father, the king. It really struck me this week how ultimately Absalom is a remarkable reflection of how Satan is described as he tried to rebel against God and steal God's glory. Ezekiel 28, 12 through 17. Ezekiel 28, 12 through 17 has a prophecy against the king of Tyre that is widely understood to also be a description of Satan's fall. I'm going to read it for you. And you could almost be hearing Absalom described here. You were the signet of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering: sardis, topaz, and diamond, beryl, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, emerald, and carbuncle, and crafted in gold were your settings and your engravings. On the day that you were created, they were prepared. You were an anointed guardian cherub. I placed you. You were on the holy mountain of God. In the midst of the stones of fire you walked. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created until unrighteousness was found in you. In the abundance of your trade, you were filled with violence in your midst, and you sinned. So I cast you as a profane thing from the mountain of God and destroyed you, O guardian cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Your heart was proud because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. So Absalom is showing a remarkable similarity to God's great enemy, Satan. And this kind of description shows up all throughout Scripture. When a person becomes obsessed with their own ability or beauty or strength, they are headed for a fall, beginning to end. Even just in the remarkably simple and brief description in the second to last book of the Bible, 3 John, verse 9, John writes to this church, I have written something to the church, but Diotrephes, who likes to put himself first, does not acknowledge our authority. There's a simple description of Absalom as well. Or simple description of sin. He likes to put himself first. And clamors after being first, shaking his fist against any authority that would stand in his way. So Absalom showed people what they wanted to see. They were looking for an impressive king. And he showed it to them. And he told people what they wanted to hear. What's described here in verses 2 through 6 is Absalom sitting out in the gate of the city, which is where the elders of a town would often sit, and somebody who needed a ruling of justice would come to the town elders in the gate. Well, in Jerusalem, David was the center of the judicial system. Ultimately, cases that could not be solved by others would come to David. So when someone came to Jerusalem looking for justice, they were probably coming to David. That was one of the common rules of a king. And yet, Absalom would intercept them at the gate. And he would pat their back and tell them how important they were and how right they were in their grievances. Now, never mind that it was impossible for every single person who came to David to be right and just in what they wanted. Imagine two people coming to be heard on the same case from opposing sides. But Absalom wasn't worried about whether he could actually follow through or whether what he was saying was actually true. He was telling the people what they wanted to hear. Even though he had to lie about David to do it, he would tell people, the king has no system set up for hearing your grievances. Well, we heard earlier in the book how David had carefully set up a system so that people's complaints could be heard. We've seen actually that the best way to get through to David's heart, even when it was hard, was to bring something before him that called for justice, and he would be, you know, his conscience would be pricked and would go out toward the person who needed justice. So Absalom is giving an entirely disingenuous description of David to anyone who comes by. And so, in a what have you done for me lately kind of world that existed back then, just as it does now, David's unifying and strengthening of the nation were too easily forgotten. As this aged man, probably now about 60 years old, David, begins to pale in comparison to the youthful vigor and political savvy of his son. People were ready to be impressed by someone more flashy. Absalom has all the advantages of the opposition party. So in politics, the opposition party is the one that's not in power, the main party that's not in power. You've got whoever's controlling the government at a given time, and then the opposition party has all the advantages of being able to play to the crowd and make promises that people want to hear. Often with no real expectation that they're really going to be delivered on. People just like to hear it. And so in modern politics even now, the pendulum swings back and forth from one side to the other. And here, the pendulum swung from David to Absalom in the court of public opinion. Absalom was seeking glory from people rather than from God. He's remarkably similar to the Jewish religious leaders that Jesus confronted in the passage that Tim preached for us a couple weeks ago from John 5. Remember in verses 41 to 44 of John 5, Jesus said this about himself and about those around him. I do not receive glory from people, but I know that you have... But I know that you do not have the love of God within you. I have come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me. If another comes in his own name, you will receive him. How can you believe when you receive glory from one another and do not seek the glory that comes from the only God? One of the characteristics of David throughout his reign is that he had sought the glory that comes from God. And yet the people are now chasing after Absalom because Absalom is seeking the glory that comes from people. And so in turn, then, if he comes to power, they can feel good about their human situation. We've got a great earthly king. Never mind whether he knows God at all or not. This is a poor reflection on Absalom, but it's also a poor reflection on all the people who were led away by him. Let's continue in verse 7 and see, now that Absalom has set the stage, how he takes advantage
of this
groundswell of support he has raised. At the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, "Please let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed to the Lord in Hebron. For your servant vowed a vow when I lived in Geshur in Aram," that's where he was in exile, "saying, if the Lord will indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will offer worship to the Lord." The king said to him, "Go in peace." So he arose and went to Hebron. Absalom had been back in Jerusalem for 2 years before our story started. Now it's been another 4 years. It's been 6 years total since he was last in Geshur. But now, after 6 years, he's suddenly religious. It's strange timing. He suddenly remembers this vow that he made to God that calls him to go to Hebron, which was another key city of Israel, the city in which David had first been recognized as king in Israel. And he needs to pay a vow. He needs to make a sacrifice to God, apparently in gratitude for God bringing him back out of exile. It should have been suspicious. We're not told if David was suspicious, but David gives his blessing. And ironically, the last words that were ever recorded as hearing David speak to Absalom are, "Go in peace. Father's peace, go in peace." But Absalom's purposes in Hebron were anything but peaceful. But Absalom, verse 10, "But Absalom sent secret messengers throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then say, Absalom is king at Hebron. With Absalom went 200 men from Jerusalem who were invited guests, and they went in their innocence and knew nothing. And while Absalom was offering the sacrifices, he sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city, Gilon. And the conspiracy grew strong, and the people with Absalom kept increasing." And so now the dam has burst, so to speak. This has gone too far for David to be able to stop. Absalom has the critical momentum. Absalom's conspiracy is successful. Now, we could certainly make various applications of what we see Absalom doing. We've already described how we see a bad heart on display in Absalom, a self-centered, prideful heart, and I hope it's easy for us to reject that approach. However, stop and consider ultimately what's going on with Absalom. One of Absalom's deep problems is that he is discontented. He's next in line for the throne, apparently, but he wants it now. He doesn't want to wait for Dad to die. He wants to take the throne. And by the way, what's going to have to happen if Absalom is successful, in order for him to be secure on the throne, is David's going to have to be killed. But what's behind it all is he's discontent. He doesn't have the power that he wants. He doesn't want to live at odds with David in this situation where Absalom is not willing to repent. And so he just kind of is living in this limbo situation. As one man put it, he has a strategy devoid of character. His focus is not on growing better as a man. His focus is on taking what he can get, because he's discontent. And so I wonder, how often is this our approach to discontentment? Rather than focusing first on the joy of growing in godliness, in spite of our circumstances, or maybe even through our circumstances, when we find ourselves being discontent, our first question is, God, how do you mean for this to draw me closer to you? What does this show of what I'm worshiping instead of you? Often we instead focus on changing our circumstances. God, I couldn't possibly be happy in this situation in life, in these circumstances in which I find myself, therefore I have to change things. That's what Absalom is trying to do. He just has more opportunity for power than most of us ever will. This isn't the main point of this passage, but I think it's a helpful application to apply this to the church, because I think the closest application of this isn't to world politics or isn't to national politics. Remember, David is ruling over the people of God. And so our first application might be to how we relate within the New Testament people of God, the New Covenant people of God, the church. Okay? And one man pointed to an article written by Ray Ortland, which is brief enough that I'm going to read the whole thing. It's very convicting to me about how we interact with the church when we are discontent. The article is called How to Rescue Your Church in 3 Weeks. Week 1. Walk into church this Sunday and think about how long you've been a member, how much you've sacrificed, how underappreciated you are. Take note of every way you're dissatisfied with your church now. Take note of every person who displeases you. Take note of all the new people whose presence is changing your church. Meet for coffee next week with another member and share your heart. Discuss how much your church is changing and how you and others are being left out. Ask your friend who else in the church has concerns. Agree together that you will pray about it. Notice how it's all clothed in a nice spiritual disguise. Just like Absalom was clothing his trip to Hebron in a spiritual disguise. Week 2. Send an email to a few other concerned members. Inform them that a groundswell of grievance is surfacing in your church. Problems have gone unaddressed for too long. Ask them to keep the matter to themselves for the sake of the body. As complaints come in, form them into a petition to demand an accounting. Circulate the petition quietly. Gathering support will be easy. Even happy members can be used if you appeal to their sense of fairness that your side deserves a hearing too. Be sure to proceed in a way that conforms to your church constitution so that your petition is procedurally correct. Week 3. When the growing moral fervor, ill-defined but powerful, reaches critical mass, confront the elders with your demands. Inform them of all the woundedness in the church, which leaves you no choice but to put your petition forward. Inform them that for the sake of reconciliation, the concerns of the body must be satisfied. Whatever happens from this point on, you have won. You have changed the subject in your church from gospel advance to your own negativity. To some degree, you will get your way. Your church will need several years to recover. But at any future time, you can do it all again and keep your church exactly where you want it. It only takes 3 weeks. It's written by a man who's been through that sort of thing a time or two. And I'm not sharing that now because of any particular concern with any particular person, which is why it's a very good time to mention it. But we need to remember it. Discontentment and ungratefulness can be, they're a cancer. They're like weeds that spread so easily. It's amazing to me how easy it was for Absalom to rouse this kind of rebellion against David. But sin loves to be deceived by what it wants to hear. And so let us be very careful. And the ultimate thing I took away from that article is we need to ask in any situation, is this conversation likely to turn my heart or my eyes or anyone else's heart or mind toward the gospel? Toward the great Savior that Jesus is? Is it likely to help us draw closer to Him? Now, there are times when change and correction are needed. There are times where confrontation is needed. I'm not trying to say those shouldn't happen. But the way in which they're done says a lot about the why. All right? And we must be careful. Christ deserves a church that as much as possible is unified in seeking after Him and living for the praise of His glory. Well, it's an ugly season in the life of Israel. But in the face of ugly treachery, God's beauty will be shining through in the life of His chosen king. So now we move on, secondly, to David's flight. David's flight from Jerusalem. And if we have eyes to see, we're going to see the beauty of God on display in how He cares for David and those who are faithful to him, and in how He helps His own beautiful character to shine throughout of David. Verse 13, and a messenger came to David saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom." Then David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, "Arise, let us flee, or else there will be no escape for us from Absalom. Go quickly, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down ruin on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword." And the king's servants said to the king, "Behold, your servants are ready to do whatever my lord the king decides." So the king went out, and all his household after him. And the king left 10 concubines to keep the house. And the king went out, and all the people after him, and they halted at the last house. Some people question here whether David is displaying a kind of cowardice as he decides to leave rather than fighting for the city. But I think his good intentions and his wisdom are described right here. He recognizes that Absalom has a more powerful force with him than he will have in Jerusalem. And lest people in Jerusalem who are expected to fight for David lose their lives at this point unnecessarily, David decides to leave. He'd rather take the battle out of the city where civilian casualties will be lower and it just can be army forces loyal to him against Absalom's forces. So he's making a good move here, I think, as he heads out of the city. We see a king who appears to be losing on the run, and a would-be king who appears to be winning Absalom. And as we go forward here then, starting in verse 18, we're going to see a number of other characters, and we're going to see their wisdom or their foolishness on display in which side they choose. Will they choose the apparently weak king who appears to be losing, or will they choose the apparently strong would-be king who appears to be winning? And as we go through this, then we will consider in a world where oftentimes our Lord Jesus appears to be losing in this world, will we choose the side that appears to be losing? Will we remain on that side? Will we be faithful to Him? Or will we go along with our own desires, our sinful desires, the world around us? Or will we follow the God-given desires that God puts in His people by His Spirit? The key that these people who David will meet should have been focusing on is not apparent weakness or strength, or even past sin. What they should be focusing on is one's present heart before God. This should have been their means of evaluating present or prospective kings. This should have been their way of evaluating alliances. And yet, for so many who did not have a heart after God themselves, they will choose the wrong side. David and those loyal to him are going to head east, out of Jerusalem, ultimately seeking to get across the Jordan River. They'll have a measure of safety if they can get the Jordan River between them and Absalom's pursuing band. And so that's the direction they head. It will seem to many people, as David is on the run, like God has abandoned him. But anything but that is true. God is faithful to David. And in fact, God is refining him. So much of the ugliness that has been on display in David's life throughout this sinful season is being rooted out, so that the beautiful character of God can be on display. And we'll see that even in his interactions with the people that he meets. David once again displays himself to be both a shepherd. I mean, that was his occupation before becoming a king. And he had taken that same concern of caring for his flock, caring for the nation under him in his rise to the throne. David is both a shepherd and a sheep wanting to be led by God. You can hear the heart of Psalm 23 in this passage. When David suffers, he begins to thrive as a worshiper. Because this is how God often works in his people. Just like we sang in that song, I ask the Lord. I ask him to help me grow in faith and hope and every grace. And how did God answer the prayer in the testimony of that songwriter? By leading him through hardship and trial. David could resonate with that song. And so let's consider these people who David meets. First of all, we'll see in verses 13 through 18 how David travels with all these faithful people, all the faithful who are wanting to stay with him. It's described that he says, arise, let us flee, let us go quickly, lest they overtake us. And his servants all say, behold, we are ready to go. We'll do whatever you decide. So they left. They took most of David's family. His son Solomon would have been about 10 years old at this time. Would have been one of the ones who would have left. David's other sons would have been very much in danger in this season. And verse 18 says, and all his servants passed by him, and all the Cherethites, and all the Pelethites, and all 600 Gittites who had followed him from Gaza, and passed on before the king. This is perhaps one of David's greater moments of shame as a king. For a king who has been anointed and appointed to rule over a people, to have to evacuate your capital because you've lost the ability to help protect and care for those under you is a shameful thing for a king. I just want us to pause and consider David's perspective here. We find this perspective in Psalm 3. Psalm 3 has the title, A Psalm of David When He Fled from Absalom His Son. O Lord, how many are my foes? Many are rising against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the lifter of my head. I cried aloud to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill. Selah. I lay down and slept. I woke again, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of many thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you strike all my enemies on the cheek. You break the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be on all your people. Verse 3, I think, describes very well the shame that David would have been feeling. You, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the lifter of my head. So he went out of Jerusalem, whether his physical head was actually hanging, in his heart, his head was hanging low. He must have been asking questions like, how did I let this happen? How did I not see this coming? How are we in a situation where all these who have been faithful to me are having to run for their lives? It's one of David's great moments of shame. Shame can be the result of something wrongfully done by you, and so that would imply guilt. Or it can be the result of something wrongfully done to you. David's shame here was owing to both. The reason he was going through this experience with Absalom, something wrongfully done to him, was as a consequence of something wrongfully done by him. One man observes this about shame. Shame exists due to our deep inner nakedness and desperate attempts to cover it. Shame exists due to our deep inner nakedness and desperate attempts to cover it, whether that is brought on by something done by us or something done to us, or both. It's the place in our hearts where, like Adam, we say to God and others, I was afraid and I hid myself. Shame is when we go into hiding because we fear our real selves being seen by another. The root of sinful shame, then, is often the answer to this question. So if we want to know, where is my shame coming from? Where is this tendency to try to hide myself from others coming from? What do I most fear being exposed or uncovered about myself? What do I most fear being exposed or uncovered about myself? Now, this shame can manifest itself in various ways. Sometimes a person's shame is manifested in great timidity, just fearfulness of being too close to others, fearfulness of being known by others, jumping from one relationship to another, can only ever get so close to anybody. Or shame can be manifested by violent aggression. The way you keep people from seeing who you really are is by asserting yourself and being dominant somehow. That can be just as much the result of shame. Okay? What's remarkable about David here
when he has great reason to be ashamed is Psalm 3's description of how he deals with it. The same author points out that David asks to be rescued from his shameful circumstance only after he has declared what God means to him amid the circumstances. Okay, so let me consider the psalm again. In verses 1 and 2, he talks about how many are his foes rising against him and mocking him and saying he has no salvation in God. And then he immediately turns in verse 3, "But you, O Lord, are a shield about me. You are my glory. You are the lifter of my head." Part of what he would be implying there is God is the one who knows everything about him. God is the one from whom he can hide nothing. And yet God is the one who draws near to him to lift him up in faithful covenant love. And so then his testimony is, "I cried aloud to the Lord and he answered me from his holy hill." He called out for God to help. Ultimately, God gave him the help that was best in the time that was best. But David only requested this after he had asked for God and declared what God meant to him. In the most shameful place, David declares that God is his protection, the shield about me, his dignity, you are my glory, and his healing, the lifter of my head. And so, it is because of that that David was able to act with remarkable coolness, like in a good way, calm and presence and dignity in this retreat from Jerusalem, amid a remarkably shameful situation, because he knew that God was his protection, his dignity, and his healing. Therefore, he did not have to act timidly, fleeing fearfully. I mean, he was fleeing wisely, but it wasn't out of timid fear. And he also didn't have to be harsh or brash or belligerent with anyone, because he had given his shameful experience to God. In the face of ugly treachery, God's beauty shined through in the life of his chosen. So we see in verses 19 through 22 that David meets, letter B here, Ittai the exile. The king said to Ittai the Gittite, "Why do you also go with us? Go back and stay with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile from your home. You came only yesterday, and shall I only make you wander about with us? Since I go, I know not where. Go back and take your brothers with you, and may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you." So I think Ittai speaks on behalf of all 600 Gittites who are mentioned in verse 18. These are people who would have been of Philistine descent, who had grown to love David, perhaps in the time that he was living in exile himself in Philistia, and now they had sought refuge in Jerusalem among the people of God. But Ittai himself had just recently arrived, and now David's trying to convince him, "Why don't you stay in the city? Why don't you claim allegiance to Absalom and just settle down as an exile here? Why should you be on the run again?" Verse 21, "But Ittai answered the king, 'As the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, wherever my lord the king shall be, whether for death or for life, there also will your servant be.' And David said to Ittai, 'Go then, pass on.'" So David is paused right at the edge of the city. It was described as the last house. And now all the people who are going to leave with him are marching on down the road, out of the city, past him. And so David says, "Go ahead, pass on." So Ittai the Gittite passed on with all his men and all the little ones who were with him. And all the land wept aloud as all the people passed by. And the king crossed the brook Kidron, and all the people passed on toward the wilderness. Then the next group of people comes along, Abiathar and Zadok the priests, in verses 23 through 29. I'll read in verse 24. And Abiathar came up, and behold, Zadok also came with all the Levites. So these are the two main priests serving at the tabernacle at that time. And they came bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God. And they set down the Ark of God until the people had all passed out of the city. Then the king said to Zadok, "Carry the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back. And let me see both it, the Ark, and his dwelling place. But if he says, 'I have no pleasure in you,' behold, here I am. Let him do with me what seems good to him." The king also said to Zadok the priest, "Are you not a seer? Go back to the city in peace, with your two sons, Ahimeaz your son, and Jonathan the son of Abiathar. See, I will wait at the fords of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me." So Zadok and Abiathar carried the Ark of God back to Jerusalem, and they remained there. So David basically says, this departure is not about me dragging God with me somehow mysteriously by taking this Ark of the Covenant with me. This is about whether God will welcome me back. I'm not going to try to force his presence with me. I'm going to focus on my own heart before God and trust that he can bring me back to the city at whatever time seems best to him. So David is, sending this Ark back to remain in Jerusalem is a sign of David trusting God. He's not going to try to manipulate the situation himself. He's not going to try to bring a good luck charm with him. But there is a strategic value in having the priests there as well. As they stay and maintain Jerusalem as the religious center of Israel, they'll be able to gather intelligence. And they can send messengers to the fords of the Jordan. And David will have messengers waiting there as well. And that can be a place where they will communicate what's going on in Jerusalem. And so David is trusting God, but making wise arrangements. Those two go hand in hand. The next person he interacts with is Hushai, the counselor. Starting in verse 30. But David went up to the ascent of the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went, barefoot and with his head covered. And all the people who were with him covered their heads, and they went up weeping as they went. A very visible manifestation of the sadness and the shame of this situation. So they've headed down through the Kidron Valley, up the Mount of Olives. They're headed away from Jerusalem. Now they're well outside the city. And it was told David, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, "O Lord, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness." This is a man who had given much good counsel to David in his reign. But now this man had turned against David. Interestingly, Ahithophel is the grandfather of Bathsheba, the woman that David had taken from her husband and then eventually taken to be his wife. We'll talk about that more next week. But there would have been good reason for Ahithophel to be frustrated with David, even though this treachery was not excusable. While David was coming to the summit of the Mount of Olives, where God was worshipped, behold, Hushai the Archite came to meet him, with his coat torn and dirt on his head. David said to him, "If you go on with me, you will be a burden to me." So Hushai was wanting to demonstrate his own sadness, his own sympathy for David's situation, his own loyalty to David. But David said, "If you go with me, you will just be a burden. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, 'I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in time past,' So now I will be your servant, if you will say this to Absalom, then you will defeat for me the counsel of Ahithophel. Are not Zadok and Abiathar the priests with you there? So whatever you hear from the king's house, tell it to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. And behold, their two sons are with them there, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son. And by them you shall send to me everything you hear. So Hushai, David's friend, came into the city just as Absalom was entering Jerusalem. So David has escaped safely. He's on the other side of the mountain, just outside of Jerusalem, safe from Absalom. Well, reasonably safe. He's got a good head start. And he has sent Hushai back in to be... this man was recognized as also giving good counsel, and he's going to be part of the answer to David's prayer that Absalom's counselors would give him bad advice. One of those counselors, Ahithophel, is trying to work against David. But one of those counselors is working with David, and that is Hushai. So the stage is set for the chapters ahead and what will happen in Jerusalem. Now, very quickly, as we wrap up, we're already an hour in them. Sorry for the length here. We need to finish the thought unit here in the first 14 verses of chapter 16. David is going to meet two more people, and these people are not loyal servants to him. These people are trying to serve someone else. One of them is Ziba, who we meet in verses 1 through 4. Ziba the servant, or so-called servant. And then Shimei, the accuser. Let's first meet Ziba. When David had passed a little beyond the summit, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him. You might remember us meeting Ziba earlier. He's the man, who had been a servant of Saul. And David had appointed him to take care of Saul's grandson, Mephibosheth, who was the last remaining member of Saul's household. And David wanted to deal faithfully and loyally to Saul's household. He wasn't acting like a typical king who would eradicate the descendants of his predecessor. So Ziba had been tasked to care for Mephibosheth, and David had given to Mephibosheth all the land that had belonged to Saul. So Mephibosheth is a well-off man, and Ziba is a prominent servant who's in charge of a lot of wealth. But Ziba met David on the far side of the Mount of Olives with a couple of donkeys saddled, bearing 200 loaves of bread, 100 bunches of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and a skin of wine. And if you're wondering, how can a couple of donkeys carry all that? There's some translation difficulty, and it could just mean a line of donkeys. Okay. This is a lot of provision that's being brought to David. And the king said to Ziba, "Why have you brought these?" Ziba answered, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, and the bread and the summer fruit for his young men to eat. And the wine is for those who are faint in the wilderness to drink." The king said, "And where is your master's son?" Ziba said to the king, he's referring to Mephibosheth, "Why isn't Mephibosheth with you? Why isn't he the one giving me this stuff?" Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he remains in Jerusalem. For he said, 'Today the house of Israel will give me back my kingdom of my father.'" Then the king said to Ziba, "Behold, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours." And Ziba said, "I pay homage. Let me ever find favor in your sight, my lord the king." We're going to find out in chapter 19, though, that Ziba appears to have been lying. He was actually seeking favor with David. Mephibosheth had been misled about what was going on, and was not really leaving loyalty to David. But David doesn't know that. So here's the point of this. At this point in the story, God is providing remarkably for David, even through the self-serving motives of Ziba. Ziba's trying to serve himself. And God is working through that self-serving man to provide for David. Because in the face of ugly treachery, God's beauty shines through in the life of his chosen king. And now finally, Shimei. When David came to Bahurim, as they're on this march toward the Jordan, there came out a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. As he came, he cursed continually. And he threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David and all the people and all the mighty men who were on his right hand and on his left. David has warriors going with him. And yet this man Shimei is running along beside them up on the hills, cursing them and throwing stones at them. And Shimei said as he cursed, get out, you man of blood, you worthless man. The Lord has avenged on you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned, and the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. See, your evil is on you, for you are a man of blood. Shimei is accusing David of being cursed for imagined crimes against Saul's family, of which David had committed none. He had acted very honorably towards Saul's family. And Shimei is not realizing God's covenant love being with David. David is indeed being chastened to turn his heart more and more back toward God, but he is not cursed. In banishing David by Absalom's hand, God is not sending David away from him. God is drawing him nearer. And Shimei didn't see it. God has truly forgiven David. But as one man put it, forgiveness does not always remove the consequences for sin. In forgiveness, your relationship will be restored to your Heavenly Father. And you will know that fellowship with Him that your heart craves. You will know that fellowship as you return to Him. But you may still face the consequences of the choices you have made. Those consequences are not a contradiction of His love, but are an expression of His love. We are so able to see sin as attractive, as not being dangerous. We are so able to tell ourselves that we are in control and nothing bad will happen. These are lies that we believe. And God would bring us to the end of that delusion by letting us taste the bitter harvest of the consequences of our sin. He does that because He loves us. And if that means limping for the rest of your life, but you limp with a heart that belongs to Jesus, that limp is worth it. And so David is limping out of Jerusalem. But he is limping with God. But Shimei doesn't understand it, and so he's hurling insults, accusing David of being cursed by God. Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, this is Joab's brother, another one of David's right-hand men, said, "Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and take his head off." But the king said, "What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? If he is cursing because the Lord has said to him, 'Curse David,' who then shall say, 'Why have you done so?'" And David said to Abishai and to all his servants, "Behold, my own son seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjaminite," referring to the man who was cursing him, "leave him alone and let him curse, for the Lord has told him to, it may be the Lord that the Lord will look on the wrong done to me, and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing today. So David and his men went on the road, while Shimei went along on the hillside opposite him and cursed as he went, and threw stones at him and flung dust. And the king and all the people who were with him arrived weary at the Jordan, and there he refreshed himself. Now there are some lessons to be learned there in how we can deal with the criticism of others, whether just or not. I don't have time to go over them now, but I'll send those out. But I do want to mention, in closing, how as we go through life, living with shame that is the result of things that we have done wrong or things that have been wrong, done wrongly to us, we all have an accuser far more powerful than Shimei. Abishai was right. He could have just run over and ended the accusation of Shimei just like that. It was only because of God-given patience that David let his life be spared. But as we walk through this life, we walk through life facing the accusations of one whose name means accuser, Satan. Satan is, as one man put it, the ultimate Shimei. Satan is described this way in Revelation 12, 9 through 11. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent, who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, "Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. For they love not their lives even unto death." So in this description of Satan, he is described not as the one who tempts God's people day and night, though he is a tempter. His first role is, his first tactic is to accuse us day and night, to remind us of all the ways we have fallen short, of all the reasons that we would deserve God to condemn us. He likes to jab at that shame over and over and over again and keep it inflamed. But how is that shame defeated? By the blood of the Lamb. By remembering that Jesus died to cover our shame. That he hung in shame to take the place eternally, or to take the place that we deserve to have eternally under the judgment of God. Excuse me. And it is when our eyes are turned to him, when we remember the glorious demonstration of God's love and favor for his people, favor that would send his own beloved son to the cross, that we can begin to step out of the hiding of shame, to really be known, because we know God's favor, we can step into relationship with his people as well and truly begin to be known and truly try to walk in righteousness and honestly try to fight sin together as we wait for the day when all things are made new. Because in the face of ugly treachery, God's beauty shines through in the life of his chosen king. And that great chosen king is not ultimately David. It's Jesus.
So our Father, I simply ask for your help that as we see David drawn toward you through this terribly trying time in his life, we would be instructed and encouraged in how we can draw to you, toward you in Jesus, how you have brought your people to you eternally in Jesus. Let our hope and our confidence and our healing be in Him and Him alone. Amen.